This is Unanimous Dissent, broadcasting from the Radio Sputnik studios in Washington, D.C. We are the District Sentinel. I'm Sam Sachs.
And I'm Sam Knight. Coming up, Trumponomics are shaping up as the president discussed his plans for the U.S. economy this morning before a meeting with a dozen CEOs. We'll let you know what Trump said and what the reaction was later in the show.
Also, Trump had to have known this was coming. He's been in office just a few days, and he's already facing a lawsuit alleging he's in violation of the U.S. Constitution. It's that pesky emoluments clause. We'll discuss the lawsuit and the possible release of Trump's tax returns later. But first, the allyship is strong within this recording studio. Sam and I were both at the Women's March on Washington on Saturday. Right, Sam?
Yeah. You were there longer than me.
Was I? Yeah.
I think you're a better ally.
Like, I was. I am, obviously. No, I like, the stage is on 3rd and Independence. I made it to about 7th and Independence, four blocks away from the stage, and was just, like, crammed against other bodies.
Yeah. And then you must have been freaking out.
Yeah, I was. I don't handle that well, but... You know, I knew I had to be out there, though.
No, I did not go out there for as long as I said, but it was really inspiring.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't agree with a lot of the messaging, but it was nice seeing all those people out in the streets. I also went around with a buddy and took some video, interviewed some people.
You just videotaped women?
All right, come on. No, we interviewed some March participants,
yeah.
Many of whom, yes, were women. And you know, we put together a little video, and hopefully we'll throw it up on...
Yeah, maybe we'll put it on the Sentinel.
Sentinel, yeah.
As Sam mentioned, an amazing event. The largest one-day protest in the history of this country. All for you, Donald. All for you, my man.
I heard it was about 1.5% of the entire country turned out against Donald Trump.
Yeah, exactly.
Those are like Iceland numbers, man.
Yeah.
That's really good.
I know, and I was talking before the march last week to Brian Becker, who hosts the show on Sputnik Radio Loud and Clear. And he was talking about the Iraq war protests and how, you know, it was supposed to be a march back in 2002.
Mm-hmm.
It was supposed to be a march.
2003.
But there were so many people there that there was no march, that like everybody just turned around and
yeah.
You're there. It was the same year. There
yeah.
was no march. In
yeah.
fact, people, organizers were like yelling at people not to keep walking to Independence Avenue because it had become a safety issue. There were too many people on that street.
Yeah.
So a resounding success, I would say. And I know a lot of people who were pretty upset about Friday, you know, that it became a reality, Trump inaugurated. But I think after seeing the crowds the next day show up, it gave them a better sense of the future, a little bit of optimism, I'd say.
Yeah, and we recorded on Friday while some of the inaugural stuff was going on. We didn't really have time to digest it fully. But one thing that was great was there was nobody there.
Yeah.
If you see a video, Katie Tour of NBC, for example, posted a video of the parade route, and the stands were just empty.
Yeah.
And it was beautiful.
And of course, the White House will disagree with that, which we'll get into here in a little bit. Also, Saturday night, the Sentinel boys threw quite a rager. We had a hell of a party with a bunch of good leftists there.
Still feeling it.
Yeah, I think if you combined, you know, being outside for the march for hours and then the party that lasted until 4 a.m., my body is still trying to recover, as you can probably tell by my voice. Also, Sam and I made an appearance on Sunday night here in town at Busboys and Poets to do a live recording as guests on the Street Fight Radio podcast. We had Brian and Brett on the show Friday.
Yeah.
We returned the favor and went on their show Sunday. It was a lot of fun. We
it
were
was
also
so
there.
So much fun.
Yes.
Like, we haven't even really had time yet to talk about it,
no.
Except for now.
I just remember Sam, like, yelling about how Bannon is going to suffer the same fate as Breitbart, which is have his heart explode in his driveway.
Inshallah.
We also reamed out Trump's nominees, cabinet nominees, things like that. And we were on stage with the Chapo Trap House boys, which is always a lot of fun.
Yeah, those and the Street Fight guys were great.
Yeah.
I really liked how Brett and Brian were talking about how in the Trump era, the left really needs to reclaim the idea of sovereign citizenship.
Yeah, and also what the Chapo guys were saying about, like, our goal must be to convert normies to leftist ideology.
Yeah, and they were saying that in the context of the march as being sort of a good start because, you know, we had a lot of liberal normies alongside quite radical communists, quite frankly. I did see one Marxist-Leninist group there, and there was weird harmony, you know?
Yeah, it was good.
It was good, yeah.
Everyone should check out those podcasts, Street Fight Radio and Chapo Trap House.
Yeah.
But, you know, as I was saying, given how depressing Friday was, I'd say things couldn't have turned out much better since then. No one showed up for the inauguration, as Sam said. Millions showed up for the protests. And we had Richard Spencer get punched in the face. And right now, there is a debate raging over whether or not that was a good thing.
It was good.
Yeah, let's put this to rest right now. Punching Nazis is good.
Yeah. Yeah, it's good.
What was your favorite remix video of Spencer getting punched?
So I really like the boys Are Back in Town one, because every time the guitar strum came in, they would reverse the image. So it was like, coming in from the left, then coming in from the right. That was good. DMX, X Gonna Give It To You.
That was my favorite one right there. It was the DMX
waiting
one.
Waiting for you to get it on your own, X Gonna Deliver It To You.
I think there was a Let the Bodies Hit the Floor one, too.
Yeah,
that was good. Lots of good remixes floating around of Richard Spencer getting punched in the face.
And the New York Times article on it was amazing.
Yeah, I didn't catch that, but...
Well, it was basically just like, punching Nazis, is it okay? And basically the way they reported it is, yes, it is okay.
I'm looking up Mr. Spencer's Twitter because he had a really good tweet that I wanted to bring up following this.
He
said, oh, I've got it right here. Oh, man.
He said,
he's tweeted a lot since then. Oh, here we are. I am not what happened to me. I am what I choose to become.
You chose to become a Nazi that got punched in the face and deserved it.
Yeah. Agreed. All right.
It was just, to reiterate, the far right was thoroughly humiliated this weekend, despite, you know, their awful rise to power. And I think the left made the most of a really bad situation.
Indeed. And eventful weekend for the Sentinel Boys. Also a pretty eventful weekend for our new president, Donald Trump. On Saturday, his first full day in office, Trump decided to stop by the CIA. Just as millions of Americans were pouring into the streets to protest him, which clearly didn't bother him at all. Trump's visit to the CIA was eye-opening, since this is an agency he accused of engaging in Nazi Germany tactics just a few weeks ago. And there was something else interesting about this speech at Langley, and I want to play a clip of it here. And you notice if something seems off to you. Mind you, Trump is speaking in front of, you know, solemn, apolitical CIA officers who he's been going to war with for weeks, yet... Take a look at this reception he received.
We were unbelievably successful in the election with getting the vote of the military, and probably almost everybody in this room voted for me, but I will not ask you to raise your hands if you did. But I would guarantee a big portion, because we're all on the same wavelength, folks. We're all on the same wavelength, right? Who knows?
So there's a lot of cheering, a lot of laughing at his jokes at Langley. Trump really owned the room, it seemed like. He was killing it. Looks like any beef with the CIA has been squashed, right? Well, no. The Washington Post's Greg Miller tweeted Saturday that CIA staffers who were seated in the front rows were not cheering. Instead, the cheerers were, quote, a self-selected bunch of CIA employees who signed up to come in on Saturday to see the new POTUS, mostly Trump voters. Reporting adds that a poll reporter selected to witness the closed event indicated that the cheering and clapping was not from the CIA, but people who accompanied Trump. So Trump went to the CIA to give a speech, and he brought a group of supporters with him to cheer him on. And by the way, he delivered the speech in front of the CIA's memorial wall, which commemorates agents who have died on duty, which didn't sit well with some former CIA people, including CIA Director John Brennan. He slammed Trump's speech. Brennan's former deputy chief of staff, Nick Shapiro, said that the former director was, quote, deeply saddened and angered at Donald Trump's despicable display of self-aggrandizement in front of CIA's memorial wall of agency heroes. Shapiro added in a statement provided to Newsweek, quote, Trump should be ashamed of himself.
I mean, come on, Nick Shapiro. You should know better than that. I mean, is he even capable of being ashamed of himself?
True. Now, as you'd expect, the White House is refuting this report. Sean Spicer, the press secretary, who we'll get into later here, said, quote, "I don't think that's accurate at all. If you listen to the audio, you can hear the excitement that exists there," which doesn't really speak to the claims being made. Yes, the excitement can be heard, but it was excitement from people Trump brought with him. Spicer went on to claim that the administration's presence there was, quote, "a very small footprint of 10 people at most." But Spicer's denials aside, I'd say that bringing a cheering crowd along with him is behavior that fits in perfectly with what we've already seen from Trump. And I said this over and over again during the transition period that Trump, really his job, you know, when he tried to offer Kasich the VP job and said, "You're going to be in charge of both domestic and foreign policy, I'm going to be in charge of making America great again." When Trump says that, he's talking about putting on the show.
Yeah, for sure.
And, you know, whenever he's hoping to avoid criticism or hoping to distract people, he puts out all this pomp and all these lights. It's why he was bringing Kanye West to Trump Tower while at the same time dodging questions about conflicts of interest and assembling the wealthiest cabinet in U.S. history. It's like, don't pay attention to that. Pay attention to Kanye, who's here at Trump Tower. This whole episode at CIA speaks just to that. Here's Trump, clearly not upset at all or trying to compensate for his weak inauguration crowd sizes.
Definitely not mad about it.
Definitely
He's
not
laughing
mad.
About it.
He's
it's
laughing.
Funny to him.
It's all funny. Here he is bringing throngs of cheering supporters with him. And this isn't the first time Trump has done this. In fact, he kicked off his campaign in the exact same fashion. On Inauguration Day, the Federal Elections Commission released a report examining Trump's presidential announcement last year when he was flanked by crowds of cheering supporters. But as the Hollywood Reporter first revealed, the Trump team actually paid a talent firm to produce those cheering supporters, basically to hire actors at $50 a pop for a total of $12,000 to cheer on Trump when he announced for president. By the way, Trump's campaign didn't pay those $12,000 until several months later after an FEC complaint was filed and this became public information. Ultimately, since the FEC is toothless and gridlocked, it didn't take action here. It noted that the total amount of money involved, $12,000, was too small. But I guess it's perfectly okay to now hire actors. That's always been okay, I suppose, to hire actors to boost your appeal at political events. But regardless, it's still weird as hell.
It shows how
deeply insecure our new president is, that he feels the need to bring a cheering crowd around with him. And really, this is all deception. On day one of his presidency, Trump is already relying on deception. And really, lucky for him, he's assembled a team around him that's more than happy to push that deception. We've got Sean Spicer, who is willing to, on his very first press briefing, actually this was more of a press statement he delivered on Saturday, Spicer lied to the media and the American people over an insignificant issue like Inauguration Day crowd sizes. And then you've got Kellyanne Conway coming out the next day and defending Spicer's lies, calling them alternative facts. It's our new favorite term to come out of the Trump administration, alternative facts.
Yeah, that's
Like, what the? If on day one, this administration is willing to lie right through its teeth over something as meaningless as an inauguration crowd size, then imagine how we'll handle more important things. Sean Spicer lied 5 times in 5 minutes on Saturday. 5 times in 5 minutes. It's hard to do that if you're trying to do that. This is all truly, truly unsettling. And it's not just me that's unnerved by this. So too are Trump's senior White House staff. I'm just going to read from a New York Times report here on Monday, quote, "The lack of discipline troubled even senior members of Mr. Trump's circle, some of whom had urged him not to indulge his simmering resentment at what he saw as unfair news coverage. Instead, Mr. Trump chose to listen to other aides who shared his outrage and desire to punch back. By the end of the weekend, he and his team were scrambling to get back on script."
Who do you think the first resignation is going to be?
I'm going to get into this here in a second. I think it's probably going to be Sean Spicer. And this, because this whole Saturday briefing in which he lied all the time might have actually been a setup. New York Magazine's Gabriel Sherman, who's been reporting extensively on Trump for the last year and a half, noted that Trump never really wanted Spicer to have the job, and that he might have sabotaged him here. And I'm just going to read some of Sherman's tweets. Quote, Trump's problems with Spicer are reflective of his larger distrust of establishment GOP. He views Spicer as a Priebus guy, referring to Reince Priebus. As I reported last month, Trump remains distrustful of Priebus because Priebus told him to drop out after the Billy Bush tape leaked. That was the tape where Trump bragged about sexual assault. Sherman added that Trump sent Spicer out to give a statement yesterday, a longtime Trump advisor says, but afterward Trump said, quote, he was terrible, referring to Spicer. New York Times' Maggie Haberman reported that, quote, one person close to the administration was blunt just now. Trump's issue with Spicer was not just substance, delivery, but visuals.
His suit didn't fit, to be fair.
Yeah, on Saturday.
On Saturday, Spicer's suit didn't fit.
Spicer, by the way, has long had a contentious relationship with the press. The Washington Post relayed a story from when Spicer was in college, and he wrote a complaint to his college newspaper after it had called him Sean Sphincter. Spicer, or Sphincter, wrote, quote, I'm writing in response to the article in the April 26th edition of The Voice in which my name was misspelled. Spicer went on to say that it was a malicious and intentional attack. And here's the kicker, my favorite part. Spicer added, quote, the First Amendment does uphold the right to free speech. However, this situation goes beyond the bounds of free speech.
Okay, Sean Spicer's name is now Sean Sphincter on the show.
Yes.
That is definitely happening every time.
Regardless of whether Sean thinks us calling him Sphincter is unconstitutional, he's pretty much guaranteed that us and lots of other people will continue to call him that.
Yeah, you're wrong, Sphincter boy. Read the Constitution.
Spicer did have a second chance on Monday to face off with the media. We're going to talk about that when we come back. Spicer's second chance, his first actual press briefing, which took place today on Monday. We're going to play some clips and talk more about that right after this break. Welcome back to Unanimous Dissent. The Two Sams still here with you from Washington, D.C. Check out the website, districtsentinel.com. We've got some stories coming up this week to check out.
Yeah, got to be honest, fam. We didn't have time to get to it this morning. We were out late with the street fight and Chapo Boys last night.
Yeah.
And, you can't be sweating all day. You know, you need a breather every now and again.
True.
Yeah.
We spent, check out our website. Anyways,
it is good,
maybe you'll
yeah.
see some stories you haven't read yet.
And by the way, yeah, when we write our stories, we try not to just have it like good within the 24-hour yeah. news cycle.
We've also got our podcast up on the website, too.
It's a Check good them out website.
There.
Go
visit it. It's a great website. So we mentioned in the first part of the show Trump's eventful weekend, which included sending out his press secretary, Sean Spicer, to lie 5 times in 5 minutes about the size of Trump's inauguration. Well, Spicer was back in the press briefing room on Monday to face off with the media. And he started off by telling a joke about how much he lied on Saturday.
I was going to start with a little recap of the inauguration, but I think we've covered that pretty well. By the way, just as I get started, I know that Josh Earnest was voted the most popular press secretary by the press corps. So after checking my Twitter feed, I shot Josh an email last night letting him know that he can rest easy, that his title is secure for at least the next few days.
He sounds like such a weasel. Like,
yes.
What is it with this whole, you know, Trump sort of marshaling the alpha male, whatever, the MRA dudes, and one after another, he just gets the biggest dorks who just
yeah.
sound like they really need wedgies, Spicer, Mnuchin, okay.
Spicer, you know, confirming that he probably won't be a very popular press secretary because he lies so much. Spicer also announced some changes in the briefing room, saying that the White House will install Skype stations so that journalists who live 50 miles outside of D.C. and don't have credentials can participate in the briefings. I have a feeling that we won't be allowed to participate. Although we're in D.C., we don't have credentials to the White House. Maybe we could get in that Skype question, but given the fact that we've decided to call Spicer Sphincter, I doubt we're going to get an invite anytime soon.
Give us credentials, sphincter.
Spicer also defied norms, and instead of calling on the wire services like AP and Reuters to ask the first question, he first called on the New York Post, the Christian Broadcasting Network, and Fox Business. In fact, I don't have a problem with this. I mean, I think it's been kind of problematic that during the Obama years, at every press briefing, the same like six people got to ask the first questions all the time. So I think it's good to mix it around, let other people ask questions. I think it is a bit troubling that the first person who got to ask a question at the Trump briefing on Monday was the New York Post's Daniel Halpert, who I know actually I've been on TV with and debated him a few times. Halpert wrote an anti-Clinton book titled Clinton, Inc., The Audacious Rebuilding of a Political Machine. He was given the first question. As you can guess, it was a softball question. As far as policy goes, Spicer suggested that Trump may move quickly to approve several pipeline infrastructure projects that had been derailed by protests during the Obama administration. Take a listen here.
Question about Keystone and Dakota Access.
I'm not going to get in front of the president's executive actions, but I will tell you that areas like Dakota and the Keystone Pipeline, areas that we can increase jobs, increase economic growth, and tap into America's energy supply more, that's something that he has been very clear about. I think he talked about it not only on the campaign, but around the Thanksgiving period. He was talking about that being a big priority.
That being a big priority, you know, we all felt really good about those victories in Keystone and more recently against the Dakota Access Pipeline. But I'd say it's time to get back to work right now because the Trump administration, and this is similar to what Steve Horn, the environmental journalist, warned us a few weeks ago, for every one killed pipeline project, expect three of them to pop up in its place.
Pipeline Hydra.
Yeah. Let me also just say a lot of people are praising Sean Spicer, saying that this was a good first press briefing on his part. I guess grading him on a bit of a curve following Saturday's debacle. I don't see that at all. He's a lying weasel. And this was a disaster of a press briefing. And the fact that we have DC establishment journalists praising him shows how they're not up to the task of covering the Trump administration. Moving on. The Trump team, they've engaged in the theatrics over the weekend that we've mentioned. Well, beyond that, Trump is also wielding his power. He signed three executive orders on Monday. The first one was actually a decent one, one that began the process of withdrawing the U.S. from the Trans-Pacific Partnership, something Trump promised he would do and is doing it. The president said he will dispatch his trade team to negotiate with each country individually on trade agreements. Of course, no guarantee that that will be any better than the TPP. These could all be very bad bilateral trade agreements, but that seems to be the course the new administration is going to take here.
Yeah, and especially keep on the lookout for a bilateral deal between the U.S. and the U.K.
Yeah, we got Theresa May coming into town this week.
Exactly, and one that would obviously London and U.S. New York City are big financial centers. Look for that to be an absolute gift to Wall Street, the U.S.-U.K. bilateral deal.
Yeah. Trump's executive order also banned U.S. foreign aid from going to overseas organizations that assist with abortions, because that's what, you know, Trump responds to 3.5 million people, women marching. He responds to make it harder for abortion access around the world. He also instituted a 5-year lobbying ban on anyone who works in his administration, and he signed an order implementing a hiring freeze for the federal government. Federal government is the largest employer in the U.S., so a hiring freeze isn't exactly the best way to go about creating jobs, I'd say. So Trump is off and running here, and so too are efforts to get him kicked out of office already. A lawsuit was filed on Monday by the group Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, or CREW. The group's accusing Trump of violating the Emoluments Clause in the Constitution. Also signing on to this lawsuit are legal minds, former White House ethics lawyers and Supreme Court litigators, including Lawrence Tribe, Norman Eisen, and Erwin Chemerinsky, and Zephyr Teachout. Now, the Emoluments Clause, as we've talked about on the show before, prohibits any person holding an office of profit or trust under the United States from accepting any present emolument, office, or title of any kind, whatever, whatsoever, from any king, prince, or foreign state. And since Trump hasn't really divested from his businesses or his Washington, D.C. hotel, the lawsuit, he risks accepting payments from foreign governments, which would violate the clause. The Times reports that, quote, the suit, which will not seek any monetary damages, will ask a federal court in New York to order Mr. Trump to stop taking payments from foreign government entities. Such payments, it says, includes those from patrons at Trump hotels and golf courses, loans for his office buildings from certain banks controlled by foreign governments, and leases with tenants like the Abu Dhabi Tourism Office, a government enterprise. Now, Trump's team has argued that his current business ties are all cool and that paying a hotel bill shouldn't count as an emolument. But as Zephyr Teachout argued, foreign officials could rent out rooms in Trump hotels as a way to send a message to the Trump family. She said, quote, if you think other countries are not going to try to leverage relationships with Trump's companies to influence trade or military policy, that is naive. During today's press briefing, Spicer was asked if Trump would release proof that he has indeed removed himself from his business operations. And Spicer initially said the proof was already out there before he was then corrected by Kellyanne Conway in the room. And then he just told reporters that they should just trust him on this.
Sean, will the president release documents showing that he has left his businesses?
I believe we have. Oh, is he?
Oh, wait.
But yeah, he has resigned from the company, as he said he would before he took office. Don and Eric are fully in charge of the company. He's taken extraordinary steps to ensure that that's happened.
Just trust us on this. And you might remember Trump's press conference a couple weeks ago where he had all those papers and folders on a table, and he claimed that these were all documents he had signed giving up his business. And then they wouldn't let reporters see what was actually in the folders. One reporter got up there and there were blank pages in one of the folders he was able to look at.
Oof.
So, yeah, we have yet to see proof about this. Another goal of the lawsuit could be to force Trump to release his tax returns, which astoundingly he has not yet, in which Kellyanne Conway said over the weekend that he won't. Quote, we litigated this all through the election, she said. Now, this refusal to release tax returns, even as WikiLeaks turning on Trump, publishing outfit has often been defending Trump and even, as we all know, assisted in publishing leaked emails that wounded the campaign of Hillary Clinton. But on Sunday, WikiLeaks tweeted, quote, Trump counselor Kellyanne Conway stated today that Trump will not release his tax returns. Send them to WikiLeaks so we can. WikiLeaks added that Trump's breach of promise over the release of his tax returns is even more gratuitous than Clinton concealing her Goldman Sachs transcripts. Looks like Julian might be sticking around that embassy in London a bit longer, unfortunately.
That would own if WikiLeaks took down Trump.
Yeah, that would be.
I mean, obviously,
it would also
anyone...
make a lot of liberals look silly. I can't wait till WikiLeaks publishes Trump's tax returns and takes on, and then all the people who've been accusing WikiLeaks of being a Russian agent are like, "Oh, WikiLeaks is good again."
Well, let's not count our chickens before they hatch. But I think it's a hype. Well, there's a good chance it could happen. I don't know. I wouldn't rule it out.
Yeah, I wouldn't either. Moving on, some news about Jared Kushner. Our favorite fail son. Nothing is standing in the way now of Trump's son-in-law from getting a job in the White House. The Department of Justice Office of Legal Counsel issued a 14-page opinion last Friday saying it was totally cool for Trump to appoint Kushner to the gig despite anti-nepotism laws on the books. The Office of Legal Counsel argued basically that anti-nepotism laws apply to executive agencies but not the White House itself. It also cited a 1978 law that gives the president broader authority to make White House appointments. Now, just reading from that legal memo right now, quote, we believe that the president's special hiring authority permits him to make appointments to the White House office and that the anti-nepotism statute might otherwise forbid. An attorney for Kushner, Jamie Gorelick, welcomed the news about Kushner's appointment, saying, quote, we believe that we had the better argument on this. The Office of Legal Counsel of the Justice Department, in an opinion by a highly regarded career deputy assistant attorney general, adopted a position consistent with our own. Fun fact, Jamie Gorelick was on Hillary Clinton's shortlist to be an attorney general had Clinton won last November. Instead, Gorelick is representing fail son Jared Kushner's attempt to get a job in the Trump White House. So people keep adding me about how progressive Hillary would have been. I love hearing it. Time now to turn our attention to national security matters, but we need to first sweep the room for bugs. It's time for a classified session.
We need to get into classified session.
Donald Trump's pick for CIA director, Kansas Congressman Mike Pompeo, looks set to be confirmed by the Senate this evening,
Debate is ongoing right now over the nomination. As the Associated Press noted, quote, Senate Republicans had hoped to vote on Pompeo's nomination on Friday after Trump's inauguration, but Democrats succeeded in stalling action until they could debate it on Monday. Maybe Dems will make a concerted effort after all to eat up legislative hours like Republicans did under Obama. Fingers crossed. Either way, Pompeo looks set to be confirmed.
Which is kind of problematic, as I've wrote, as we wrote about the Sentinel and pointed out on the show. Pompeo is a surveillance hawk.
Yeah, yes, he
is. At a time when people thought the reasonable thing to do last year would be to unwind the giant phone metadata surveillance program, Pompeo is writing op-ed saying we need to expand the metadata surveillance program and include not just phone information, but also lifestyle information. Pompeo has also called for the death of Edward Snowden, calling him a traitor. And Pompeo came to Congress as a result of the Tea Party and
small government.
Yeah. Mm. Small government who supports a massive surveillance database of lifestyle information. So, yeah. His nomination is particularly problematic, but will likely sail through in the next few hours.
Yep. Well, here's some sort of good news, although it's about another Trump nominee that is going through. But the cucking of Marco Rubio continues apace.
Hell yeah.
After lodging objections over Rex Tillerson's nomination as Secretary of State, Marco Rubio announced he would vote for the former Exxon CEO. His confirmation is now all but assured. Rubio had been concerned about the selection because Tillerson had won Russia's Order of Friendship for Exxon's work in Russia, but those concerns seem to have dissipated. In a rambling Facebook status, Rubio rehashed his concerns about Tillerson, filled with empty fluff about America's non-existing commitment to human rights all over the world. But, Senator Rubio noted, in making my decision on his nomination, I must balance these concerns with his extensive experience and success in international commerce, and my belief that the president is entitled to significant deference when it comes to his choices for the cabinet. As the Washington Post noted on Monday, quote, Rubio donors and other supporters who had served as Tillerson's boosters reached out early and often to try to nudge the senator to back Trump's nominee, including many from Texas, Tillerson's home state. He heard from former Vice President Richard B. Cheney late last year. Man,
old dick.
One thing Chris Christie was extremely correct about, excuse me, Marco Rubio is not a human. He's a series of circuit boards and metal sheets. I mean, the guy is a robot, folks.
Yeah.
The best thing about this, by the way, is that John McCain and Lindsey Graham had already said they were voting for Tillerson, meaning that he had the votes to get through. But so Rubio could have voted no or abstained, citing the whip count and his own reservations, being like, oh, you know, I know he was going through, but I'm not 100% there. But he didn't. Oil lobbyists berated him and he caved.
Yeah,
the guy just can't stop getting cucked.
Yeah, someone should change Rubio's settings to make him more aggressive and independent-minded rather than just, like, put it on cuck setting.
How can you teach me to love?
I think there's a little button behind his ear that if you press it, like, the back end of his skull opens up and you can change his programming.
Yeah. In other news about foreign policy, the White House confirmed that President Trump is inviting Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to Washington for a February visit. CNN noted, quote, a senior administration official said that moving the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem from Tel Aviv remains a priority for the president, but cautioned that it would not be happening quickly. The move would be designed at legitimizing Israel's claims on Jerusalem as its capital, something Palestinians dispute. East Jerusalem, the Muslim and Christian parts of the city, have been occupied by the Israeli government since 1967. Sunday's phone call was described by Netanyahu's people as, quote, very warm. As the Christian Science Monitor noted, quote, the Israeli right has celebrated the American president's victory. Education Minister Naftali Bennett, for example, reacted to last November's result by saying, quote, the era of a Palestinian state is over. So while Jewish leftists here in the U.S. are joining people of all creeds and colors to fight Trump's Nazi supporters in the streets, the state of Israel is welcoming the rise of anti-Semitism in the U.S. As long as they can keep ethnically cleansing, they're cool with it. Anyway, Netanyahu will not be the first foreign leader to visit the White House under Trump. That honor will go to Theresa May, the rabidly right-wing British prime minister who rose to power in the wake of last summer's Brexit vote, mate.
I'm sure moving the embassy to Jerusalem will go over real well in the region. And
it could cause a third intifada.
Just create peace. No, I think you're right. I think we're slowly heading towards that third intifada. More dissent coming up. Unanimous Dissent still here with you. Still broadcasting out of the Radio Sputnik studios in Washington, D.C. I'm Sam Sachs.
I'm Sam Knight.
We are the District Sentinel news team. You can read our latest stories at districtsentinel.com.
Some news today from the top of the judiciary. The Supreme Court said it won't take up Abbott versus Vesey, a battle over Texas's voter ID law. It's been described as one of the toughest such laws in the nation. The decision, however, does not put the matter to rest. The litigation had been bouncing up and down between the District Court in Southern Texas and the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. Chief Justice John Roberts said that those proceedings should play out before the Supreme Court decides whether or not to weigh in, noting in his order, quote, petitioners may raise either or both issues again after entry of final judgment. The both issues, to which Roberts was referring, claims that the Texas legislator enacted its voter ID law with, quote, discriminatory purpose, and whether the law results in a denial or abridgment of the right to vote under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act.
It does.
A lower court had issued an injunction against the ID law, saying it did indeed violate the VRA. The appellate court eventually vacated only parts of the ruling, namely the conclusions on discriminatory intent. The case has been remanded back to the lower court for further fact-finding, which is where it will stay for now. The Texas voter ID law, which was passed in 2011, as I said, is seen as one of the strictest voter ID laws in the country. Under the rules, voters would need to have a state driver's license or ID card, a concealed handgun license, a U.S. passport, a military ID card, or a certificate of U.S. citizenship with a photo. As the Texas Tribune noted, quote, experts have testified that more than 600,000 Texans lack such identification.
Something tells me that they aren't white, affluent Texans that identification.
Well, what was interesting to note in some of the wire service reports about, you know, the whole trajectory of this case is that the Fifth Circuit is one of the more conservative appellate circuits in the country, and that I think 10 out of the 15 judges on the panel or something were appointed by Republicans, and yet they still struck down a good deal of this law.
Yeah, it was pretty obvious.
Yeah. Anyway, time now for some economic news for the dang old 99%.
Food Street! High Street! Food Street! High Street! Food Street! High Street!
So Donald Trump's first full weekday as president started on Monday morning with a meeting featuring well-heeled corporate executives. Surprise, surprise. In front of the cameras, the president sat next to Ford CEO Mark Fields, lauding the man for publicly stating that November's election has caused the company to rethink their investment in U.S.-based production. Trump then used the occasion to outline his economic vision for the country. Let's take a listen, starting with Trump's thoughts on fiscal policy.
Now, what we're doing is we are going to be cutting taxes massively for both the middle class and for companies. And that's massively. We're trying to get it down to anywhere from 15 to 20%. And it's now 35%, but it's probably more 38% than it is 35, wouldn't you say? That's a big thing.
A big thing indeed. But one that could make it much harder for Trump to pay for all those infrastructure promises that helped them carry the Republican nomination and the general election. I mean, it's hard to make America great again if you have no money to do it.
Well, then again, Paul Ryan wants to just do infrastructure spending through tax cuts to companies. So
good luck.
Yeah.
Good luck with that, Paul. But no worries, according to Trump, because he has something else up his sleeve. And I wouldn't say it's huge, according to the president. It is of a much larger magnitude than the tax cut thing. Take a listen.
A bigger thing, and that surprised me, is the fact that we're going to be cutting regulation massively. Now, we're going to have regulation, and it'll be just as strong and just as good and just as protective of the people as the regulation we have right now. The problem with the regulation that we have right now is that you can't do anything. I have people that tell me they have more people working on regulations than they have doing product, and it's out of control. It's gotten out of control. I'm a very big person when it comes to the environment. I've received awards on the environment, but some of that stuff makes it impossible to get anything built.
Big person on the environment.
Big person when it comes to the environment.
Awards on the environment. He didn't list them. But I guess you don't need to when you're an award-winning environmentalist.
I like how everything is massively. I'm going to cut taxes massively. I'm going to get rid of regulations massively.
And I also love how the regulations are in, like, got to cut them, but they're going to be just as good. They're still going to be good, but yeah, I don't know. Then Trump went on to say, quote, we think we can... Sorry, I cracked up a little. Trump went on to say, we think we can cut regulations by 75%, maybe more.
That is massively.
What does that mean? By dollar amount? By number of regulations? By word count?
I don't know. Sounds massively, though.
I guess we'll just have to wait and see, because Trump, as he is known to do, offered zero specifics.
Nope.
The president then turned his attention to trade policy, as widely anticipated, a matter that also came up later in the afternoon, Sam, as you noted, that when Trump formally announced the U.S. would be pulling out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. But here's what Trump had to say on trade in the morning.
So a company that wants to fire all of its people in the United States and build some factory someplace else and then thinks that that product is going to just flow across the border into the United States, that's not going to happen. They're going to have a tax to pay, a border tax, a substantial border tax.
As the Washington Post noted, by the way, that this whole border tax plan, it's kind of, I don't know, it only exists in Trump's head as a thing. They noted in the report on this whole thing that Treasury Secretary nominee Steve Mnuchin said, quote, any border tax would be targeted at specific businesses, i.e. those that decide to offshore. However, the paper added, the president does not have the power to levy taxes, and international trade experts have warned singling out companies could violate existing treaties. But anyway, there you have it. You have Trumponomics shaping up. It's got a three-pronged approach toward making America great again that involves the imposition of tariffs, which Trump has said in the past could be up to 35%. And that also involves massive tax cuts and the evisceration of federal regulations. So if you take out the trade policy, it sounds like Reaganomics, I don't know, or as Hillary Clinton was right, I guess, to call it trumped up, trickle down, or I don't know if that phrase was right, but, you know, she was... Her heart was in the right place. Bless her.
Yeah, that was a slightly better wording than love Trump's hate.
Or dangerous Donald. Anyway, whatever one thinks of the three-pronged approach, the markets weren't all that impressed. Yields for U.S. government bonds were down Monday morning, reflecting higher demand in the financial instrument. Treasury bills, as they are known, are often seen as safe bets by institutional investors in times of uncertainty. Reflecting this caution, the stock market was also down on Monday, dropping by about a quarter of a percentage point in the wake of Trump's remarks. In addition to his meeting with business leaders, President Trump also met with labor leaders on Monday afternoon. Building Trades Union President Sean McGarvey was there. So was Terry O'Sullivan, the leader of the Laborers International Union of North America, and Joseph Sellers, the president of a sheet metal union called SMART. As Reuters reported, there were some notable groups who were left out in the cold, though. Spokesperson for the United Steelworkers told the Wire Service, for example, that they were never invited. Trump sparred with a local steelworkers union president, Chuck Jones, in December, Reuters noted, over the number of jobs United Technologies Corp agreed to save at a Carrier plant in Indiana. While in New York, though, between the election and the inauguration, Trump did meet with some major labor leaders who weren't reported to have been at the White House on Monday. Those included AFL-CIO President Richard Trumka and Teamsters President Jim Hoffa. Trumka, by the way, did praise Trump for pulling out formally of the TPP today.
Yeah, he got a few people praising him. Even Bernie praised him.
Yeah.
Said he's willing to work with Trump on trade.
But, you know, as many people have noted, that this comes in the wake of just years and years of activism and pushback from you know, activists, obviously, and Democrats in Congress. You know, Sherrod Brown, Elizabeth Warren, Bernie, they pushed back really hard.
Yeah.
And it had virtually unanimous support among Republicans until, you know, the primaries started going on. I do say unanimous, but actually I remember Jeff Sessions did vote no against the TPA markup.
That's true. But, you know, we've reported on this issue for years over at the Sentinel. So it's cool to see this play out to a conclusion, which is that TPP is dead. There is not going to be another TPP unless we get a Democrat or some other Republican in 4 or 8 years that wants to revisit it. Instead, we're going to get some other different type of trade deals coming through, if at all. Yeah, I mean,
I don't know. Maybe Trump gets impeached in 6 months and Mike Pence just picks up TPP and runs with it, as he said he would.
Yeah, we'll see.
In a separate matter, Trump was targeted for criticism by other labor leaders for his federal hiring freeze. The American Federation of Government Employees hit out at the president on Monday in response to his executive order. Union President David Cox said that the move will, quote, disrupt government programs and services that benefit everyone and actually increase taxpayer costs by forcing agencies to hire more expensive contractors to do work that civilian government employees are already doing for far less. I don't know. Maybe this will save costs. Trump is known to stiff contractors.
True.
Obviously, just, you know, a joke. He doesn't have the power as president to stiff contractors.
It's just depressing how the government is just this target. Government jobs, government workers are this target. Like, we do have a thing called population growth.
Yeah.
And as the population growth, the government needs to grow with it to be able to take care of the growing population. But that's just lost in this debate at all. It's like, oh my God, government workforce is getting larger.
Yeah.
Yes, we have millions of more people living in the United States now than we did decades ago.
Well, that's a very good point, because as AFGE President Cox added, the hiring freeze, quote, will mean longer lines at Social Security offices, fewer workplace safety inspections, less oversight of environmental polluters, and greater risk to our nation's food supply and clean water systems.
Huh.
In its report on the executive order, the Washington Post bolstered Cox's claims, and your own, I guess, noting that past hiring freezes have actually failed to keep the size of government down. In 1982, the Government Accountability Office said that hiring freezes have, quote, little effect on federal employment levels. The report also said that freezes, quote, disrupt agency operations and in some cases increase costs to the government.
And we know how many new jobs created under Obama have been mostly like low-wage service sector jobs. So a government job is a good job that people can have and get benefits on. Like, that could be a good replacement for a lot of the crummy jobs we've seen in this new economy of ours.
Yeah. And, I don't know. I guess we talked about it earlier. The Republican idea for infrastructure is very much a tax cut sort of thing, a Paul Ryan tax cut sort of thing.
Yeah.
But it seems like if they wanted to bolster the whole infrastructure thing, beef up DOT and get some sort of temporary workforce. And there are these good paying jobs that Trump says he wants to bring back. I don't know, man. This is going to be a disaster. These next few, I don't know. Anyway, in other economic news, the Trump administration said over the weekend that its plans for repealing Obamacare include the establishment of block grants for Medicaid. This move would put the crucial welfare program at the mercy of state governments and with life-threatening caps. As the New York Times noted on Sunday, quote, a block grant would be a radical change. Since its creation in 1965, Medicaid has been an open-ended entitlement. What that basically means is, as a qualifying American under current rules, you don't get cut off because of a recession, or you don't get cut off because, you know, the cost of healthcare goes up, or because you have to buy an EpiPen and the executives at Mylan somehow, you know, through their proprietary rights, decide to jack up the cost a bunch. That will all change if Republicans get their wish. Medicaid spending will be capped. People are going to die. Medicaid currently covers more than 73 million people in the U.S., about 23% of the population, and it costs about $500 billion annually. Of course, the benefits accrue to the most vulnerable people in the country. As CNN noted, quote, most enrollees are low-income children, pregnant women, parents, the disabled, and the elderly. Many governors around the country are concerned by the move, worried more about funding than control over healthcare spending. Massachusetts Republican Governor Charlie Baker, for example, said earlier this month of block grants, quote, states would most likely make decisions based mainly on fiscal reasons rather than the health care needs of vulnerable populations.
And that's the important part. I mean, block grants are the biggest scam. It's going to mean less money going to the states. It's going to be less money going to actual health care of citizens in the states, and more money going to kind of junk science like abstinence-only programs and things like that Republican governors want to call healthcare spending.
No, it's a double whammy, because you get squeezed on the fiscal side of things, And then you turn over more control to like these snake oil guys. Like, as you said, they do, you know, abstinence programs.
Yeah.
I don't know. Crystal healing can't be that far behind.
Yes. I'd actually get down with some crystal healing right now. Just speaking for myself here after this weekend.
Yeah, you're sounding a little rough there, bud.
You know, Sam and I, we do this show every day. We try and cram as many news stories as we can to get to our listeners. Often we don't get to all these stories and we promise to return to them the next day. And then sometimes it gets shuffled under and we never get to these stories.
True.
But we've got just a few more minutes left until the end of the show. So I wanted to get to this one story that I've been trying to cover on the radio for like months, but just haven't had time to. And it's all the obscene coverage complaints that the FCC received during the 2016 World Series. So people actually writing the FCC about obscene coverage during the World Series, the baseball World Series last year.
What could be possibly obscene?
I'm glad you asked that because I have a few examples that I can just read from here. First one actually is extremely reasonable. I might have written this one, and that is people complaining about the racist caricature of the Cleveland Indians and their mascot.
That's fair.
That is definitely fair. Just going to read from this letter here. It says, the racist character of the Native American man was repeatedly shown, as is the logo of the Indians team. Human beings should not be treated as mascots, and so on and so on. So that's good. I agree with this complaint. We need to do something about racist mascots in professional sports, starting also here with the Washington football team in D.C.
Big time.
Here's where they get a little bit weird, these obscenity complaints. We got Jay, who wrote to the FCC, saying that it was obscene in how Joe Buck, the announcer, was degrading the Chicago Cubs with his and his co-announcer's coverage and promotion of the Cleveland Indians baseball team and its players. It borders on indecent. It is truly a grave injustice to the television-watching community.
Bring back the fairness doctrine, but for sports.
But this is my favorite one here.
Okay.
This is about the bumping, or crotch bumping, I should say. Whoops. During Game 7, during Game 7, after a home run by Ross, he celebrated with other teammates by bumping their crotches with one another. That is disrespectful and should not be allowed. I cannot believe this was televised during a live event and nobody censored it. This is a lack of ethics and very poor taste. What happened to a handshake or a high five? Is that too honorable?
They want to criminalize crotch bumping?
Yeah, I will say I saw the crotch bumping live and was surprised that that is actually a thing. But looks like the FCC will have to deal with this before the next World Series, deal with both crotch bumping and the obscenities of Joe Buck as a baseball announcer.
They'll probably have some support from soon-to-be incoming Attorney General Jeff Sessions, who committed to reestablish. I know I've said this factoid like a million times. Committed to reestablishing a federal anti-obscenity unit at DOJ.
You'll definitely have that support. I'm glad we got to these FCC complaint stories. That'll do it for Unanimous Dissent today. You can listen to this show and all of our shows by going to the Radio Sputnik website or by checking out our website at DistrictSentinel.com. Subscribe to the show on iTunes by searching for District Sentinel Radio. And stick around for tomorrow's show. We're not going anywhere. We'll stay here in D.C., so you don't have to be.